Hello, everybody, again. This is Jughead, and thank you. Thank you very much for listening to these variations of punk rock and these underground sensational things. And sometimes we have people like today that have broken into the mainstream, but have some sort of connection to punk rock and music in general. If you would like to be a patron, we would love to have you as a patron. You can just go to our website, www.jugheadsbasementpodcast.com, press the little button that says Patreon, and it'll zoom you to a new location where you can pay $2, $5, or $10 tiers. The $5 and $10 tiers get you extra material, unedited, pre-released video of almost all of the interviews that I conduct. Plus, you get some shit that I send you in the mail when I hop on my bike and go to the post office. I have no patrons to announce this week. That's very sad, so please be one so that I can announce your name on this program. You can also give a one-time donation at jugheadsbasement@gmail.com through PayPal. You know what you can do, which would be great, and a few people have done this, but only a few, and I've had at least 2,000 downloads this week, so that means there's at least 20 of you listening. So all of you should do a review or give us 5 stars. Go to iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and they usually make it pretty easy to give reviews or just stars. We could use those. I would greatly appreciate it. That's it. Let's hear some stuff.
There's 104 days of summer vacation till school comes along just to end it. So the annual problem for our generation is finding a good way to spend it. Like maybe building a rocket or fighting a mummy or climbing up the Eiffel Tower. Discovering something that doesn't exist or giving a monkey a shower. Surfing tidal waves, creating nanobots, or locating Frankenstein's brain. Finding the dodo bird, painting the continent, or driving our sister insane.
Right now you are listening to Today is Gonna Be a Great Day by Bowling for Soup, also known as the Phineas and Ferb theme song. Welcome to Jughead's Basement, episode 66, subcategory, Lo-Fi Interviews with Hi-Fi Guests. This week featuring Jeff Swampy Marsh, animator and co-creator of such shows as Milo Murphy's Law and Phineas and Ferb. Today we talk about such things as London, Japan, architecture, and its relation to cartoon animation, Phineas and Ferb, and the integrity of mission, character, and purpose, plus much, much more. So, let us begin.
This could possibly be the best day ever. Today is gonna be a great day. This could possibly be the best day ever. Today is gonna be a great day.
We went there for the first time a couple years ago with our family. We did Tokyo, Kyoto, and we went down to Naoshima.
Naoshima. Were you there for the festival, the art festival?
And that was the place that the whole family went, okay, we really screwed up. We should have spent at least a week here. We should have come during the festival, and we're going to fix that. And our plan is to go back. So,
yeah, the festival is really great. It's, you know, you can get like a 2-day pass and just take the ferry, you know, from all different islands. And it's really neat because you'll have some really cool art where someone turned their house into something and they thought about it. And then you'll have these just one guy who said, I'm going to paint my house and my lawn black.
Yeah. That's why I like, if you've ever been to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival.
Oh, yes, 3 times. Yeah.
I love it there because you can see some really amazing stuff, some quality actors. And the next show you go to is worse than high school drama. And it's great. And I've never walked out of a show, even if it's just a slow motion train wreck. It's like, no, we're staying to see. This is great.
No, I'm right there with you. It's amazing. All there in one. I usually did do the festival. One year I decided just to go there and not be in it. And it was a lot more fun because, you know, when I'm there with my own show, I have that critical mind that you can't really turn off. And then you're able to let it go when you're not in competition.
Yeah. That's the thing that got my son to think about going to school in Scotland. He's in Stirling now.
Yeah, I have a couple of friends in Scotland, luckily, and I usually stay with them and then travel around. And I'm usually based around Edinburgh. That's where most of them live. So
his place is great. Stirling is like a 30, 40 minute train ride in one direction. He's in Glasgow, the other direction he's in Edinburgh.
Oh, yeah. I know that area then. Yeah. How I usually start these things is I've been doing these more free form interviews, and I've been starting with like a personal story, and it leads into like talking about my guest. Because as I study, like for a week, as a writer, the first thing I do is think about myself, you know, so.
With you there.
But in this one, this is more like what I call a chain of facts and coincidences that may lead into a discussion, but we'll see. Okay. First, I have to confirm something, and I'm not going to tell you why. David Lindley. Do you like David Lindley?
More than you can imagine.
Okay, then here we go. Okay, a while back, a friend of mine called me, who I met in the punk circuit years ago. He called me and said, I just met someone who reminds me of you, and I really like this guy. And that's all. He just left it there. And time went by. And then I interviewed Jarrett Reddick. And
Jarrett!
Yeah. And we talked a little bit about you and you know, about the band and how they came to be on Phineas and Ferb. And then I was like, oh, then I did some studying on you. And I go, oh, you were on two shows, or you worked on two shows that are the only two shows on TV that my band have ever been on or referenced in. So Screeching Weasel was referenced in King of the Hill as a song called Screeching Weasel. And on Simpsons, they played our song Cool Kids in a scene where he's like, I think Bart is riding on a board, and they played the song Cool Kids from one of my records. So I was like, oh, I'll get him in. And so I wrote on Facebook about this. And then my friend Sam Perry, who told me about a friend, called me, goes, hey, that's one of my good friends you're going to interview. He goes, my world is colliding. And I said, oh, you were that thing you mentioned like months or years ago was Jeff Swampy Marsh. He goes, yeah. So then I call him and go, well, look, give me some information, because I don't like to just do those stereotypical interviews where they have to repeat the same information over and over again. So he said a few things, but then he said, he's really big into David Lindley.
Yeah.
And at first I was like, oh, I didn't. Okay. But then I hung up the phone. It's like 3 a.m. and I'm doing some studying still. And I go, David. David Lindley.
Here's a visual reference that you can't get since this is an audio podcast. But I had next to me a record by David Lindley that I had gotten in 1983.
El Rayo X. Bingo bango.
I bought this record because a friend who was visiting a guy who was visiting another friend of mine from out of town was a great guitarist. And he impressed me. And he said this was his favorite guy. So I bought this record. And then bought a guitar the next week for the first time ever. So because of that, I started my band Screeching Weasel, which is what influenced Jarrett to start a band, because my band was one of his main influences.
That's pretty cool. I did not know that. I like that. That is excellent.
I really like, you know, a series of events and overlapping. It seems to be a product of our age and our sort of humor and intellectual interests are these webs of connections.
We reached out to David Lindley when we first had Phineas, and we were developing over at Disney, and they asked us, did we have anybody we were interested in working with for the scoring and for doing the music? And we're like, we're going to be doing a lot of music. It's going to be a song, a show, and we're going to write most of the songs, because we write the song as we're writing the script and the story. So they're integrated. So it's got to be somebody who can really do a lot of different styles of music and has got a good sense of humor. And I had put forward David Lindley, and we started talking about it. And Dan said, there was a guy that he was on a flight, and he was sitting next to Jackson Browne. And Jackson Browne was telling him about a guy we should hire. And I went, if it's Jackson Browne, it's David Lindley, because David was with him forever.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
He ended up calling back. He goes, it is. It's the same guy. So we talked to him and realized very quickly that he's not the kind of guy who would be readily available enough to do the work on a regular basis like we needed, which we were really sad about. But it was the Disney guys who said, would you guys be interested in working with Bowling for Soup for the title credit? We're like, hell yes. And that's how that started. And then we ended up working with Danny Jacob, who was available readily and plays all of our guitar stuff. But that's how we ended up with Bowling for Soup. And I've now since worked and written songs, and just released a single with Wally Ingram, who is David's percussion guy.
Oh, wow, wow.
Yeah.
That's so interesting. So, well, let's talk a little bit about you as a musician. When did you start, but you're a lover of music first, and then probably a musician in your mind.
My grandfather was, I grew up in a musical family.
I was just going to ask you that, if you came from any sort of a creative musical.
My grandfather is Les Brown. Les Brown and his band are renowned. He's the guy who, he started in the 30s. He was the first guy to employ Doris Day. His big hit song was Sentimental Journey. And he was the musical director for Bob Hope and Crosby.
Wow.
He was his band was on the Dean Martin show for all those years.
Sentimental Journey is one of my favorite older songs. It was it's the name of an old, like 19th century novel. And then they took the title from that.
And so I grew up playing all kinds of instruments. And I think that's the reason I never got good at anything, is that I could get lessons in anything I wanted. And I was surrounded by people who were brilliant musicians, but you'd kind of go, oh, this is nice. Ooh, what about that? And I never stuck with anything. And then finally gravitated to the guitar in, I think, junior high, because I, like most people, thought chicks dig guys who play guitar. Ended up, gigging around LA after I got back from the UK. I formed a ska band and we played for probably seven, eight years. We got some radio play on KXLU and just basically ran ourselves ragged, gigging around LA for a while till I couldn't babysit a bunch of musicians anymore and thought, okay, I got to stop.
I actually just got done with an interview with Mike Park, who owns Asian Man Records, and most of his bands are ska bands. Like, he was in a band called Skank and Pickle, which was big in the
late. Oh, I know Skank and Pickle because of Carlos Alizraki, who was the voice. He's a huge fan.
Oh, didn't know that. That's cool. Yeah. And I just had an interview with Jesse Michaels, who was from Operation Ivy, who was also very ska-influenced band.
Dan and also gigged around when we wrote the very first animated thing we wrote together was an episode of Rocco's Modern Life called Wallaby of the West. And at the end of it, we wrote this song called Wallaby of the West. We were sitting in the room and we thought we should just write a song and put it in here. Sit back and I'll regale you about my nephew from Australia. Wouldn't know a cow pie if it slapped him on the rear. He can't ride a rope or wrangle or play a good triangle. And his best friend on the planet is a steer. Rocco. it was shitloads of fun. And we played it and pitched it and they loved it. And we just kept writing songs together.
We'll sit down in our regalia by my nephew from Australia. Well, he wouldn't know a cow pie if it slapped him on the rear. He can't ride a rope or wrangle or play a good triangle. And his best friend on the planet is a steer.
That's so great. Is there a difference or is it the same chemistry to walk in a room with Dan and concentrate on like script and animation, or to walk in a room and concentrate on songs? Is there a different feel for you guys?
Yeah, songs is a lot more like play. And it's not that, I mean, we work together because every aspect of it was fun. The thing I love about Dan, and that he said he liked working with me, is that we could be brutally honest with each other. And it was never, ever personal. It was purely about the work, which kind of scared people because we'd have arguments and we'd be literally like, well, you would do that only if you're a moron. Oh, hey, it's lunch.
Oh.
And there was never that crossover. But getting the script and the story right is more of an intense process. By the time we get to the song, we know what we want to fit in there. And we just sit in a room and go, we've got a minute and 30 seconds. What do we want to do? And then we pick a style and grab a guitar and see if anyone else is free. And it's just pure playing with toys in a playpen. It's great.
Yeah. I imagine picking a style first probably helps. It limits like you're having played so many different instruments, you have to sort of limit yourself in some way. So picking a style is probably that umbrella that you start under, right?
Yeah. And, you know, you're trying to figure out what's the mood that we're trying to capture here? What are we trying to do and say? And either you're playing completely against it. Like one of my favorite things we ever wrote was It's a Perfect Day. And it came up because we had a montage sequence where Candace is being chased through the streets by wild animals. Because Phineas and Ferb have built a translator, which translates into animal. Mm-hmm. And she's had a big rant about how much she hates animals. And they all get angry and chase her. So they're going through. We wrote this song. It's a perfect day. It's in the mid-70s. Humidity is 60%. It's a perfect day. Not a cloud in the sky. We pitched it to Disney and they're like, that's not the song you're going to use. We're like, yeah. Like, well, it doesn't fit what's happening. We're like, yeah, we know. That's the whole point. Otherwise, we'd write some song that I'm being chased through the streets by wild animals. I don't know. This just seems funnier. And that to me is just the pure play of the music.
It's a perfect day. It's in the mid-70s. Humidity is 60%. It's a perfect day, not a cloud in the sky, and I can say without fear of descent. It's a picture postcard, perfect kind of a summer afternoon. It's a perfect day. It's a perfect day.
That resonates with me, the idea of that comedy is, people who do it well, is played on levels. Like if everything matches up, like the comedy goes away.
<You know>? Yeah. Comedy is surprise. It's setting up an expectation and then deceiving it. And that's what we tried to do with the, you know, the music in the show as well, is to get the humor everywhere we could. We did a really great number when Phineas and Ferb were building a rocket. It was the first jazz number that I'd written. And I was so proud of it because I thought, oh, my grandfather would have loved this. And he passed away in 2001, never got to see the show. But we wrote, let's take a rocket ship to space. I hear it's a real swinging place. And behind it, we actually licensed all the footage of all the NASA rockets blowing up on the launch pad as Phineas and Ferb were testing their rocket. And so it's this wonderful, great Frank Sinatra style tune with just mayhem going on behind it. We had the best time doing it.
Well, that's just like the you probably raised on the Naked Gun movies and the Naked Gun series, where with him saying nothing's going on here, nothing, and there's everything's exploding in the background.
Please disperse, nothing to see here, please.
It also reminds me of the Zucker brothers, and I always often talk about how what Mel Brooks may have happened to him is he didn't learn from his own, the people that were influenced by him. Like the Zucker brothers basically took what Mel Brooks was doing and then sort of expanded it to the environment, to the background. Like the actual comedy was going on in the back while this boring conversation was going on in the front. It sort of, they added levels to it, you know.
Which gave you a chance to watch it over and over again. I remember watching Airplane in the UK at a theater. I was living in England. And I'm sitting up in the balcony where you could drink and smoke back then.
Yeah.
And half of the movie, and everybody who saw it enjoyed it and thought it was funny. But I literally laughed twice as much as everyone else. Mm-hmm. Because all of the jokes that were about television that I grew up with were funny to me. And nobody, and I remember people in the theater would be like, why is the American laughing? And it was great just to be, you know, and then I tried to explain half of them to people afterwards and it didn't work.
But yeah, explaining comedy doesn't always work. I had that in Japan. It's hard to see a lot of different movies because the movies that make it over, of course, I can't watch Japanese movies because I don't speak well enough to actually, and they don't have subtitles because they're in Japan. They don't need subtitles of their own language. So you usually see just blockbusters. But I often find myself laughing alone because in general, the Japanese are quiet just to begin with and they don't like to stick out. But I often wonder whether it's the translation or is it the culture, the differences? And then I just have to focus in on the movie and have fun.
We used to, when we were gigging around town, our bass player's mom used to own a Japanese restaurant and piano lounge down in Gardena near the Honda factory. And all the Honda execs used to come over. And we used to go there after gigs for free food. And I used to go. I remember one time just went up to the bar and picked one of the songs. We said, Ue o muhuite, areko yo, namida na hobore na hiyo. The guy from Honda summoned us over. Yeah. I'm like, oh shit, it's the Honda exec. I probably said it wrong and I'm in deep poop. And we ended up becoming friends for the entire time he was there. He'd buy us drinks and food every time we came in. He was the nicest guy. I did a drawing for him when he left that was just my version of kind of an animated samurai. And he looked at it for the longest time. He looked at me and he went, his legs are very long. Well, you know, I'm a white guy. My legs are long,
That's the one thing about the Japanese too, is they're very honest and straightforward. Like if you're fat, they'll say you're really fat.
Yeah.
and you're still skinny, but you're like fat. And to me, often they would say, ooh, like women would say, your face is very straight, John. Straight? I think most faces are, depending on what angle you know. Something you had said just a little bit earlier in the conversation triggered this note that I had. I know you went through a bunch of different careers. Like you poured cement, and I sort of related to that because I tarred roofs.
Ooh, that's yeah.
That's always one of those stories you tell when you're like, oh yeah, you know, I put the band through, you know, touring just by tarring roofs in this hot sun. And but I'm more interested right now in the movement to the use of backgrounds. Is that what you started first in when you started animating?
My only actual artistic training was architect. I went to Reseda High School, go Regents. Out in the valley, and we had a drafting teacher out there, Mr. Pelagi, who was brilliant. We used to win at least two places in the city drafting contest every year. First and third, first and second, second, third, you know, always some combo. He was incredible. And I took architectural rendering from him because I'd always drawn since I was in first grade, but art teachers and I tend not to get along very well. I've been kicked out of so many art classes or left for various reasons, but I really enjoyed doing that. And I had perspective skills that were kind of stupid. Like I know stuff about perspective that no human really needs to know. And so when I quit my job in the computer, and I was a computer executive, vice president of sales and marketing for the computer giftware company. Wow. And I had a buddy who said, well, you should get into animation. Sure, I have no idea what I'm going to do. And if I wait too long, I'm going to lose my house. So, okay. And he taught me to do backgrounds and helped me get a portfolio together. And 3 months later, I had a job on The Simpsons. And it was just drawing backgrounds because they needed people with perspective skills. So when they looked at my portfolio, you know, David Silverman, the supervising director, went, oh, you're hired. I went, you know, I have no animation. He said, no, we'll teach you that.
You got the skills that we need in order to nurture.
We need to have you teach other people perspective.
Okay.
So I spent the next 2-3 years learning what everybody around me was doing. That's how I spent my lunches. It's like, can I watch what you're doing and ask you questions? And
yeah.
Figure out how to do other things in this business. But it was all just drawing backgrounds.
I took an interest to that also because one of my best friends is a great artist, and he drew the logo for Screeching Weasel, our logo for our band is on more bodies, and some people have it on shirts. That it's almost like the Ramones, where some people don't even know like the band, they just know the logo.
Yeah.
But his other career was, he was in the ground floor of Halo. Like he came up with the name Halo, you know, the Xbox game.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow, dude.
So his talent from, because he was in the company called Bungie, which was in Chicago, and then they were bought out by Microsoft, and then they moved to Seattle, I think. But his job was walls. He's responsible for all the walls in Halo, like all the background. And I'm one of those friends of his that I'm fascinated with people's jobs in general. But even if they have to do with art, I'm like one of the few that would be like riveted when he's talking about him working on bricks and the right textures.
You know, I was one of those people who didn't understand how animation worked, or I probably would have sought it out sooner, but to know that there were these specific disciplines within that I didn't need to know how to animate Bugs Bunny. Mm. I could just draw backgrounds, and then I could learn how to draw props, and then I could learn how to design characters. I learned just enough animation to know that I hate it. That line, you know, moving frame by, God, I'm not that guy. I'm a big picture dude. I can't. Mm. There's a Dutch word for it. Muurenoker. Mm. Means ant fucking. I can't do that. It's a great word. I love Dutch. But I can't do that minutiae. And so my skill set ended up being developed in storyboards and directing and big picture stuff. And I found I could do that really well and let guys that were skilled at that do the animating. I loved figuring out what backgrounds did to a scene and what perspective did to your emotion and all of that. And I love playing with that. And that translated into camera angles and what the different camera angles automatically makes you feel and how that affects the scene and your perception of the character. Mm-hmm. Really subtle stuff changes how you feel about a character. It's like music behind a scene can completely change the entire context of that scene. And it's the same with subtle perspective stuff.
Hmm. Off topic, but in topic reminds me of another Japanese. I studied I thought it was important to learn a little bit about the Asian philosophy compared to like the Western, because it's so different. And I didn't want to be one of those stupid Americans that make assumptions like, why do the Japanese do it this stupid way?
What's wrong with you people? We do it different. It's much better.
I was surprised that some of the wand keepers were like that. Like, why do they do it that? That's ridiculous. It's like, no, if you understood a little bit. But one of the fascinating things for me was our focus more on the object and the Asian focus more on the action or the surrounding area. And one of the things they did in this experiment on this documentary was they did the survey where they have a person in the middle that's happy and everyone around him is happy. Then they ask Americans or Westerners, oh, is this center guy, is he happy? Oh, yes, he's happy. Then they ask the Asians the same thing. Is the center guy happy? Yeah. And then what they do is they change the background people to being angry or sad and the front guy is happy. And they ask Westerners, is this guy happy? And they go, yeah. They ask the Asians and it was about 95% would say no. Then they go, why? He's smiling. Why isn't he happy? He goes, well, he can't be happy because everyone around him is not happy.
Wow. I like that.
Yeah.
Wow.
So that it relates to me about how backgrounds are important to the setting of the mood, setting of like who the characters are.
Yeah.
Do you find yourself, I mean, your projects from there have moved on to like Phineas and Ferb has a lot of actions. Did you still concentrate most on the backgrounds or were you now moving yourself into dealing with all the aspects of it?
No, I mean, the backgrounds kind of became the secondary part. My architecture teacher would be so proud. The one building that I ever designed that actually made it into the public arena was the Doofenshmirtz Evil Incorporated building, which I literally drew to try to make the worst possible design for a building ever. So I took responsibility for that side of it because I cared. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I would always have the notes on, you know, background designs and things and background philosophy. But it became, you know, less about the individual background and more about how that played into the rest of the story. But one of the reasons I think we did so well with Phineas and Ferb is that we had two people who came out of a writing directing background. And we both knew the characters intimately. I mean, the number of times I had people ask me a question and I'd give them an answer and they go, oh, that's the same thing Dan said. And it's like, A, don't do that thing where you ask, you know, dad, and then you don't get the answer you want, ask mom. And I don't know which one of Dan and I was mom or dad, but there you go. Because we know the characters the same and 99.9% of the time, we're going to give you the same answer. But because we could divide our duties that way, we could maintain the integrity of the characters over a wider number of shows. And that was great. And Dan, I ended up favoring a little bit more the design side. And voice sessions. I ended up being the voice director.
Oh, cool.
And Dan leaned into more on storyboards and animatics. So that's kind of the way we divided. But the big bulk of the storytelling and what stories we told and the dialogue and everything like that, that was kind of the middle bit that we all participated equally.
Rocco's Modern Life.
Rocco's Modern Life.
That leads me to, I watched part of a documentary on Rocco's Modern Life because I didn't know much about it. I missed that whole, I was on tour from the 80s through the 2000s, so I missed a lot of TV during that time period. But I went back and I grew up in improvisation. Like I went to Second City, I taught there.
Nice.
And a lot of the people that are actually running comedy in LA now or America are all people that I had worked with. But I was fascinated to see that, what's his name? Murray?
Joe Murray.
Was brought on not just writers, but a lot of improvisers at the time because he wanted that sort of feel in the room. And now my question, I guess, I'm formulating it now, but we talk about architecture, which is very... I mean, what I know it is very lined and perspective. And then there's this influence that you were working on Rocco's Modern Life, where you were probably around improvisers or spontaneous comedian people. I'm just wondering how you, do you feel you balance those aspects in not only in yourself, but with the people you work with?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's fair. I think somebody kind of needs to make order of it. I always said to people, somebody has to make the decisions at the end of the day. Mm. When I got my first directing job, I called up an old family friend, a guy named High Averback. He was good friends with my grandfather. He used to direct like I Love Lucy and MASH.
Oh.
And I called him and said, you know, hi, I know you're not an animation director, but I got my first directing job and you're literally the most successful director I personally know. What advice do you have? And he laughed and he goes, it's easy. Your job as a director is to make decisions. Make them as quickly as you can, as best as you can, as quickly as you can. Because if you've made the wrong decision, you will find out quickly and you'll have time to fix it. If you don't make a decision, one will be forced upon you and usually at a stage of the production so late that you can't fix it. So really, that is the job of a director, make decisions. Hmm. And that's how I kind of worked it with them. My job is to foster, as a showrunner, is to foster an environment where everybody feels like they're free and comfortable to bring any kind of weird, wacky ideas and say dumb stuff, stupid stuff, you know, all the weird, they just a safe environment to be insane. And then at the end, somebody's got to bring that in and go, okay, here's what works within the structure that we've got. Here's what doesn't violate the characters. Here's what, and, you know, and take all of that and condense it down. And that's more that, you know, orderly architectic, you know, architect side that mm-hmm. says, okay, let's take all this insanity and let's make some sense out of it. As opposed to like Frank Gehry, who crumbles up a piece of paper and leaves it on the table and says, you guys design that. That's what I want my building to look like.
That's funny you said that. Because
stories about him.
I when you had mentioned the building that couldn't stand, I thought of that guy because the crumpling the piece of paper and say, design that.
My wife's an architect. She went to SciArt with several people who ended up working for Frank. She's got we're still friends with somebody who worked for Frank for ages.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Designing a remodel for us. But yeah, those things where he'd come in and, you know, with a piece of ribbon and go, there you go, like that. And then I'm going to be on my boat. And then he'd come back in when they'd done it and go, what did you do? Those weren't the walls. That was the roof. Like, yeah, crazy whack job.
I watched one of the many things I tried to watch. I watched your hour special where you were talking about Phineas and Ferb. Really, really, really great.
You did that for an hour?
You did that for an hour. It was just you. There was a...
God!
Well, be honest, I made it to really like 30 minutes.
I applaud your stamina.
One of the things I noticed is you talk... it came up a few times. I tried to keep an eye on words that are repeated. And you talked even jokingly about you and Dan having big egos. And part of that, you're serious. And part of it is just being, but I also noticed just from talking to Sam and talking to Jarrett and just watching you that you seem a very compassionate man. I mean, and I know that I've been told that you're a very loving father. So it just seems an interesting, and they're not contradictions, but I'm just curious, in, as I am with many things, of those balancing of these, knowing that you have to have a bit of an ego to get your ideas across, but also being a very compassionate man. I can see it in your eyes that you take in what other people are feeling. Does that make any sense to you? Is that something you deal with as?
Yeah. I mean, somebody else was talking the other day and they said, the one thing I know about you is if I fuck with your people, I'm in deep shit. Mm. And it's true. The people that I need to create an environment for the people who are doing the work and respect them and make sure it's safe for them to look like idiots. Cause that's basically our job, is to go out and look like an idiot. I play the idiot card very heavily and expect others to as well. And yeah, I all those people, I care about them deeply because they're taking a risk on my behalf. The ego part is funny. It's, you have to be egotistical enough to believe in yourself, to know that your ideas are right, to be able to say, to be able to be open to an idea that might be good, even if it's different than yours, but also to be able to say no. I was talking to somebody earlier. One of the first notes we got from Disney on Phineas was, would you guys object to us making the characters more attractive? Which is a nice compliment, you know. But we said, yeah, actually we do. And we'll explain why. We're not being dicks.
Yeah.
But if you make this look like everything else that's out there or everything else that's on your network, there'll be no reason for people to see it. And they're not going to embrace these characters because they're attractive. They're going to embrace them because of their personality. The Simpsons were never that attractive. Rocky and Bullwinkle were never that attractive.
No, no.
But people connected with them. And you've got to give them a reason to stop and look at it. And a guy with a Dorito head is going to make you go, what the frick is that? Hopefully pause long enough to learn something about him that compels you to watch the show more. But Dan and I had achieved enough in our careers. I always said I was glad we didn't sell the show in 93, because I don't think we'd have had the courage or the ego to defend the things about the show that were important. And that's what you get. It's like when Disney said at one point, we couldn't say the word divorce. And I went, well, why not? And they said, well, we don't say divorce on the Disney Channel. And I went, well, that needs to change. Because Phineas and Ferb are from a blended family. They're stepbrothers.
Right. Yeah.
And if you don't say the word, you're telling half of your audience, all these kids out there, that their family situation that they're living in is so bad that it's unspeakable. And you don't have the right to do that. And so it was literally one of the first deal breakers for me. It's like, if we can't do that, I'm not going to be able to work on the show. I come from, my mom's been married 7 times.
My dad was married 4 times. I was going to talk about that to you too. Yeah, I know. Stepbrothers, half sisters.
You're like, you have to be able to portray these people as a normal, loving family and say words like divorce and let kids that are watching it know that that's okay. And I think that's where I talk about ego. You have to be able to sit up and just kind of go, no, you're wrong. There's stuff we can talk about and we can debate, but there, you're just wrong and I'm right. Suck it, loser. That takes getting to a place in your career. No, I've been around a while. We're not talking about that one. And I've gotten better at telling people, you know, like we had some things on Pete the Cat that I remember saying, I don't want to give you the impression that this is an area for discussion, because it isn't. There are certain things that we're just not going to discuss because it's only going to go this way. And there's plenty of areas we can have discussions on, but these are the ones where we can't. That's the ego part.
Pete the Cat, yeah, he's our man. He knows where it's at. Pete the Cat. Pete the Cat.
But I also realize one of the great joys that I found wandering around talking to people about Phineas and Ferb is 90% of the time when somebody comes to me and says, you know what my whole family loved about that show was Klimpaloon, the magical old-timey bathing suit that lives in the Himalayas. That was great.
The magical old-timey bathing suit that lives in the Himalayas. They call him Klimpaloon.
Wasn't my idea. had nothing to do with me. All I had to do was look at it and go, that's funny.
That's yes. good. Yeah.
And most of the stuff that was brought in like that was stuff that our writers and storyboard artists and even production people came and said, what about this? And some of it you even went, no, wait a minute. Actually, that's pretty.
Yeah, you're right.
And we just had to make sure that we could do those things without violating the characters or the rules of the world that we set up. And as long as we could do that, and so much of it, the giant floating baby head and tons of it were stuff that I didn't think of any of this stuff. I got joy out of saying, oh, I created an environment where people felt comfortable bringing those ideas to the table and saying them out loud. How cool is that?
That reminds me also, you talk about the positivity or the avoiding the humor that's just making fun of somebody, which when I heard you talk about that, I'm all on board. It makes comedy a little bit more difficult, but I'm all aboard it. Cause I've always wanted to write this paper about irony in like comedy through the years. And I was a big fan of Real Genius, which was a movie in the 80s.
Yeah. You know,
Val Kilmer.
Went to school with Val Kilmer.
Oh, did he? But let him know. That's one of my favorite movies. But it reminded me of the old Marx Brothers where the evil people were the ones that got the comeuppance from the Marx Brothers. And that sort of was the same in what I liked about Real Genius. Like he was a slacker, but he could tell he was, and it was almost like Meatballs too with Bill Murray. So what I'm talking about, there was this sort of ironic in the 80s that moved to more like with Chris Farley and a lot of these David Spade guys moved a little bit more where everyone became the butt of their jokes. Mm-hmm. And a lot of humor took a turn that I didn't really care for as much, where it was more of a free game where the lead person was always just making fun of everybody. And that humor came out of that. And maybe it's my old guy thing, but I craved a little bit more of that, the compassion of the main character to choose what's evil and what's, you know, the hold up. So I don't, it's not even really a question, but you can talk about it. I just respected that sort of holding to that feel.
I wanted to clarify a little bit here because it is something I want to write about eventually. But the irony I'm talking about is more about what Camus talks in The Myth of Sisyphus, is where, you know, he has to roll the rock up and down that mountain and it keeps rolling back down and he has to roll it back up. But Camus always envisioned him doing it with an ironic smile, you know, like facing diversity and the impossible with a bit of a smirk. And I think a lot of those characters did that, but allowed for compassion. Val Kilmer's Real Genius character was looked like he couldn't get anything done, but he was actually ends up being the him and the genuine character that they're usually acquainted with become the heroes of the story.
We have to credit being on the Disney Network to some degree is that, you know, we had parents that worked at the channel who said, you know, there's very few Disney shows that I'll let my kids watch. And it's because they were populated with jerks and idiots. Mm. And at the end of it, there was a stuck on message thing. Oh, darn, that was wrong. Shoot, I won't do that again. And then they do the same thing next episode. Mm. And then we started thinking, well, can we make this show without all of the humor being based on jerks and idiots? And it is harder, but it's so much more rewarding. And it's so much fun. And every writer that we've ever had on the show has told us in some form of, this is the hardest show I've ever worked on, but it's the best when we get it right. And it's because they can't use all of the tools that they've normally been using. And we were very clear about what things Phineas would and wouldn't say and would and wouldn't do and what Candace would and wouldn't do. She was trying to bust her brothers, but she'd never lie to get them in trouble. She would never hurt them. She didn't want to hurt them. She loved her brothers. And it was this very tricky balancing line all the way through. Mm. But we just loved the fact that that wasn't the basis of all of our humor. And it's something that immediately when it went out, people started coming to us and they were able to say that and identify it, saying, I love the fact that it's not mean-spirited, mean-based humor. Phineas isn't even trying to get away with anything. We avoided desperately playing mom and dad as either jerks or idiots.
Yeah, his goal is just to have the best day ever, every day. that makes me wonder about how even Doofenshmirtz is so likable. And were there discussions about, oh, we can't do that because that's going to question. That's got to be interesting sort of balancing trick too, because he's the bad guy. but he's almost more likable than, he's almost more real than the rest of the characters.
And the thing is, he never had to be a real evil bad guy. I love the, we had an episode where Vanessa, his daughter, was the one who really got to sum it up when he said, yes, but I'm evil. And it's like, Dad, you're not. You're just a really nice guy who wants to be perceived as being evil. And you're kind of trying to live up to that. And it's not making you happy. It was this great speech.
Maybe you're not so bad a dad. Not so bad.
We liked that he was really just this kind of misunderstood guy who didn't know how to solve his problems and was kind of super smart and had this wonderfully tragic, like all the backstory stuff. We didn't imagine that either. Somebody else did that.
Yeah.
All his backstories. But you look at it, and so many people have noticed it online too, saying he's a really good dad. He cares about his daughter more than anything else, absolutely more than evil. He even goes to Perry to say, could you help me, you know, with my daughter?
Yeah. The party scene where he helps him decorate the party for his daughter's birthday is beautiful.
It's a really nice. It's a great one. That's the one episode we did where everybody is helping each other.
Yeah.
All the enemies are, and that's why it's still, when people ask me, most of the time I cite that show as my favorite one.
I just got done with an interview with a musician from a band called Lawrence Arms, who I really respect the way he writes. And he, like me, is a novelist and a musician. And he talked a lot about how character over premise or story. And then in your thing, I heard you talking about premise versus script or no script, that you don't work with a script. Not that these are contrary, but I wanted a little bit more clarification of what that, how that process works, where you're actually going to Disney and saying, we don't want this to be a script.
Yeah. That was a fun discussion.
But you're also very, your character stuff is, it's very character driven too. So like I said, I don't think those are contrary, but I was interested in your phrasing of like premise over script.
Well, what you don't get with a script is a visually driven show. I've always said, you know, once you're at about your second revision on a script, now you're just wasting time because you're trying to solve visual problems with words. So at a certain point, you're just writing more words. Mm-hmm. You have to stop. Once you get your structure and everybody agrees the structure is there and that you understand who the characters are, that script needs to be flexible. Because we find all the time, there's so much stuff that we wrote that we never needed to say. And you can show it much better than saying it. We used to have that phrase, the trees are made of wood. There used to be lines in there that would be, you know, the equivalent of, oh, look, he's leaving the room through the door. Yeah. Why are we, nobody needs to know. And that's what doing it as a board driven show, as long as you're really clear about where you're trying to get to, what the journey is. And for Phineas and Ferb, it's really easy to do board driven because we know where we're going at the end of the day and that we have to reset. It's harder to do it on other shows, but it allows the humor to evolve with the pictures. And so you can change direction when stuff doesn't work and you don't feel like you're a slave to that script. And then the hard part comes in with Dan and I, is we have so many different people writing for him. Dan and I would go in and redo a lot of the dialogue, not that we would change the nature of it, but just to make sure that the words were being used were words that those characters would say.
Yeah.
We used to have one of our board artists, really great guy, French guy named Antoine Gouveau. Great artist. We've worked with him for years. But I remember the times when he'd be telling the joke and the words were all out of order. Very French, and he'd be trying to get it right. We're like, dude, we know exactly the joke you're telling. It's cool. Just keep moving. We'll be writing. Just, you're fine. Right. We study it. Okay. And that's the part we knew we could fix, but getting the timing and the visual humor and all working was much more important. And that was, you know, the best for us. We went on to our next show, which was Milo Murphy's Law. Mm. But that is a really complicated show involving time travel and pistachios from another dimension. And wow. And that we couldn't do as storyboard driven. We really had to map a script out so everybody knew where we were going. But then we would also say to the board artist, you're free to change the dialogue and to move things around as long as we're getting the same place and hitting the same spots. It was just tighter. a more abridged playing field.
That reminds me of like I always refer to this game when I write sometimes, the game of Mousetrap, where it's about the series of events that, you know, lead to the mouse getting caught. It's like you have to think about all these steps in order to make this thing that looks random happen correctly.
Yeah. It should look easy and natural.
Look at that sun, look at that sky, look at my sweater vest, I look so fly. Look at that mailbox, look at that tree, it's about as beautiful as it can be. Whoa, today is gonna be exceptional, never boring even for a minute. It's my world and we're all living in it. Whoa, never boring even for a minute. It's my world and we're all living in it.
Another, I would imagine, difficult with Milo Murphy is the, of course, sticking to that, the Murphy's Law. And what I heard, I think Dan say, which I thought was very interesting, is that they had to be realistic, not magical happenings.
Yeah.
So that takes some time too. So I imagine, like, the not being critical of other characters of each other, that seems like another element that really, you, once someone brings you an idea, you have to dig into it and figure out, well, is that real or not?
It used to drive us crazy. It's like, it can't be magic.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Phineas and Ferb do things like create an animal translator. It's like, I know it can't be realistic, but they have to be able to achieve it through a perceived use of science and engineering. You know, you can't just say, we've created a magic wand, or it doesn't work that way. Mm. And it's, you know, sure, we're stretching the reality and possible, but it can't be magic. And that was important to us. That it wasn't, because then it, you know, then it breaks the reality. There's no feeling that they've actually achieved something. They've just waved a wand.
Right. Yeah, there has to be limits to that in cartoons. Anything can happen. You have to put the limits on that.
We had a great one working out the, they were flying around the world with the sun to have the longest day. And we started trying to figure out where they were flying and time zones. And somebody came in and said, why do you care? You could just make it up. And it's like, no. Then it doesn't feel real. And I know it's not real, but it needs to feel real. And that, to me, the whole trick of animation is getting to the point where this drawn thing feels real to people. Mm. When people perceive of Phineas as being a real person. And a lot of that is, you know, achieved by the illusion that they're thinking. But, you know, it's keeping whatever reality you've set up for that world needs to be maintained. Hmm. And whatever reality you've set up for that character. It's why Phineas couldn't just get angry. People would write stuff and it would just, all of a sudden he's angry. It's like, Phineas doesn't get angry. So if you want to get him there, you have to work for it. You've got to set it up. You've got to track it. You've got to earn it.
Yeah.
And it's hard with a character like Phineas.
This is a side one that I just thought of. Ferb is mostly silent. Is that happen randomly sometimes where you just go, oh, we're going to have him say something? Or is there any we sort of pattern pitches. To that?
Sometimes, you know, somebody would have him say stuff and we'd go, no, either he's over talking. It's like, why would he say that? My thing with him was always, he's Steve McQueen, man. Steve McQueen was the only actor in Hollywood who used to go through and erase lines from his script.
Yeah.
Like, look, I don't want to say stupid stuff. I want to say the important things.
Remember how to shoot this, right?
Yeah.
Okay, it's got a full clip. Bang, 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 bang. Okay.
And that's how we always felt with Ferb, is that he'll talk, but it needs to be important. People used to come and bring us stuff like with Ferb holding up cards, like he was mute. It's like, Ferb isn't mute. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have to mime things. That's not how it works. He can talk anytime he wants. He just chooses not to. So you have to work out ways. And that's why we used to have ends of conversation with Phineas finishing the conversation or saying, oh yeah, Ferb was just telling me this whole story about some weird stuff. But then Ferb's moment to speak was always heavily debated. And it was fun to play with.
Because she's a tire spinning, gear grinding, clutch burning, backfiring, paint trading, redlining, overheating, throttle stomping, truck driving girl.
I used to teach a physical workshop, and in comedy and in just acting in general. And that was one of the harder lessons to teach people, is being silent isn't being a mime. Like, and I had to do the simple exercise of, you want a cigarette and there's someone standing next to you and you want one, but you don't have one. How do you do that? And people would go like, and point to the cigarette, you know, and no, that's miming. That's not, you know, you can look in your, feel for your pockets, look at the other person, you know, it's very subtle. And I imagine in animation, that's extremely important too, especially when you have a quiet character.
My favorite thing we used to have with animation was people would feel the need to have people act with their hands, which used to drive me crazy. And it was really obvious when you'd have Monogram, who's Perry's boss, on the screen.
Yeah.
And they would do things like, I don't know Perry. And because he was such a tight screen, he had to shove his hands up. I have an idea. Let's go over there. And it's like, in real life, have you ever done that to someone without it being a comedy moment of, you know, irony, saying, I have an idea. That's a joke. But nobody would go, I have an idea. Let's go over there. I don't know why.
You know? Unless it's an episode about him trying to express himself more.
Somebody told me I needed to talk with my hands more. So
I think the last thing I want to hit is something I just learned by reading, that your name Swampy, that you adopted as your, do people call you Swampy in your regular day life?
Pretty much everybody, but my mom, my brother, my grandkids call me Opa.
Yeah.
My wife still calls me Jeff. My son calls me Papa. Other than that, it's pretty much Swampy.
But is this true that this didn't, I know you have an adopted father and that you changed your last name to Marsh, which was his last name, right? But is it true that this name didn't come starting to be used until after you were in England? Read that, but is that true?
I'd had people joke with it about it. But it never really stuck. It was never a thing until I got to England. And I was working in a nightclub there, the Timepiece Wine Bar and Discotheque, which the Timepiece is still there. And in fact, I redesigned the logo for them a short time ago.
Oh, wow.
Which was really fun. Got to redo their t-shirts, which is cool. But yeah, somebody was joking around and they were started doing, you should have a nickname. We should call you Boggy or Spumpy. And I'm like, Boggy. Nobody calls me Boggy. And I think I was about 3 or 4 beers in that night. And I probably made a big deal of it for about 15 minutes, just enough to where the next day when I got there, everybody said, hello, Swampy. And then everybody called me Swampy. My friends in America heard about it. Yeah. And I was just Swampy after that. And you either fight it and give people a tool to flog you with, or you just accept it. It was easier to accept it.
In these sort of magical worlds as writers we build, I have this thing of you going to England to find yourself, and then you go back for Phineas and Ferb, and you have this new nom de plume Swampy that now.
It was funny. I had that nickname when I was working as a computer executive. I mean, I used to work with Bill Gates and Scott Oakey and all those guys up at Microsoft. People don't trust you as an executive with a nickname like Swampy, but once you get into animation, it's an absolute boon. Everybody remembers you. People felt that they've worked with you before, and your name comes up on the credits really big. Dave Silverman was the guy who did that for me. Mm-hmm. I was writing that name on all my sheets, and he goes, Swampy, really? You want people to call you that? And it's like, dude, it's been that way for years, is what it is. He's like, I'm going to give you credits that way. And I went, yeah, okay.
Yeah, all right.
I got comfortable with that long time ago. So that's how it showed up. And later they had to issue a thing to people saying that you're not allowed to have nicknames on any of your paperwork or anything, unless your name is Jeff Swampy Marsh.
That's great.
And I never got to work on a Halloween episode because Dave said, if you ever get to work on a Halloween episode, you're going to be the only one without a nickname. I'm like, oh, that'd be fun. And then I never got to work on that. I was like, that.
My mom used to always say, and then it was also in a movie in the 80s, but she would love that phrase, wherever you go, there you are. Yeah. And it's something that comes back to me all the time. And I know you maybe did move to England to change yourself or to be different, or I don't know the circumstances of it, but what do you think that move to another country and then coming back did to you?
the thing that I have taken away from it that I'm the most grateful of consistently, year in, year out, is how it taught me that other people around the world want different things and how important that is to remember. It's really easy to assume that everywhere you go, people want the same things that you do to be happy, and they don't.
Yeah.
People's criteria for happiness is completely different. And it's one of the reasons, you know, why we had Baljeet as a character on the show. And I've always talked about, we didn't get it right all the time, but we really strove to make sure that Baljeet was a fully dimensional character. And it was because of somebody I met there and realized there's a whole different world of people that think differently than we do. And you need to be respectful of that. It's like you're talking about in Japan, not making assumptions about people and not, why do you do it that way? That's stupid. It's like most of the time, there's a really valid reason people are doing things differently than you or thinking differently than you. They've grown up in a different place. And I love that. And there was a great humility that brings. It's like, yeah, I don't know everything. And I have a lot of great English friends over there who reminded me of that on a regular basis. I would happily go back there again. I love working with those guys. There was something joyous about working on it, on stuff in England. And that's, you know, everybody over here has got some other project going. Everybody, you know, every waiter has a screenplay.
Yeah, right.
You know, everybody's an actor and actresses. And everybody you talk to in animation is working on their own thing on the side. And that's really cool. But England has a really great way to me for most of the people there. It's like, right now, I'm here. I'm working on this. Somebody's paying me to be here. And everybody was connected to that project and making a lot less money. But they were there and they were present. And I really appreciated that and really enjoyed it. And wanted to bring, if I could wave a wand and bring that over here, that would be great. So that people were actually doing and invested in the job they're getting paid to do right then. And it's not that they don't have their dreams and their own project, but those are later. When I'm at home, when I'm on my own. And there was just that great feeling that we're all here doing the job.
And do you feel you brought that to your work?
Always tried.
Yeah.
Always tried. And I think you do that really well by, what I tried to do at my studio was create an environment where it's, look, we're all going to be on this. We're all going to be focused on this, but I'm going to create times when we can all come together and talk about what we're doing and get the benefit of everybody's help. So we used to have like once a month, all of the people in the studio, we'd have take time out where everybody could sit around and pitch their projects. No ownership to the studio, no nothing like that. Just bring it out and we will happily critique it and give you ideas, all absolutely no obligation free, just to try to make it better. The trade-off for that is, when we're not doing this, you're working on what we're doing.
Focus, yeah.
And that was really fun.
That's amazing.
I love England. I'd happily go back there again and work. I've always got at least two or three projects that are potentially going in the UK. I think I have three right now. Well, hopefully when you're back over in the States and got some time, we'll actually meet up. Come on down to Venice. We'll go grab a beer.
All right, Swampy. Thank you very much.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks. Thanks for asking me, man. I appreciate it.
Not a problem. All right. Have a good day.
All right. You take it easy.
See you. Something got a hold on me.
It should be
you have made it this far. Very interesting. It was David Lindley with his song Something's Got a Hold of Me from the album Win This Record that came out in 1982. I played that one because it was one of the reasons I actually started playing guitar. It's the reason I bought a guitar. I didn't really start learning how to play it until me and Ben started Screeching Weasel, and I really, really, really didn't learn how to play until I started Even in Blackouts. But anyway, David Lindley is one of Swampy's favorite performers and writers, so I thought it would be good to put on here. So, Patreon, do it, please. Donate some money if you can. It really helps out. I've gotten up to almost $200 a month, and I'm using a good half of that on music that I buy for the show. But anyway, there's lots of stuff that go into making a podcast, and I would like you to help if you could. Thank you very much. Share this podcast. Share all the podcasts with friends, enemies, dogs, cats, rabbits, naked mole rats. They need some entertainment. They look like they're having fun and they're dark holes, but, you know, they could use some entertainment. That's it. Thank you, everybody. Goodbye for now.